Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here and Chad Marquitz both hosting this weekend show, and I want to refocus everybody on some of the daily editorials we recorded throughout this week, because as the week started off with some high volatility and a pretty sharp sell-off in a wide range of markets, the markets bounced back shortly after on Tuesday, to be exact, and then the tail end of the week, a little bit quieter, really just goes back to this whole summer doldrums trading. But back to the daily editorials that we were posting throughout the week, we were covering a lot of the short-term moves in the metals and U.S. markets, but also a lot of company updates. So please go back and check out those company updates, because right now, even as markets are slow and unfortunately precious metal stocks still under a bit of pressure, good time to get up to speed with a lot of companies and at least maybe trim your shopping list or isolate those companies a bit more. That being said, let's get into this weekend show, which we will focus a lot on active investing in mostly the resource space. Shad and I are starting off this show with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Now, Matt, you just sent out your investor letter, which I will provide a link to for all of you listening to read over. His full investor letter takes you through the allocation of the MJG Capital holdings and broadly Matt's strategies. Let's start off with a strategy you've had really throughout this year, and that is increasing the portfolio or the fund's cash position. We've talked about this on prior calls this year, but so far, that's been a great strategy in the resource sector, unfortunately, because stocks have been drifting lower. Matt, take us through the reasoning behind this strategy and if you're continuing to build up cash currently.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me back on the program, gentlemen. Always good to be with you. You're right. I mean, that's been one of the very key focuses over the past 6 months here. The other is just sitting tight and being disciplined. So we've only initiated two new positions over the past 6 months as well. But the fund as of June 30th is at a 12% cash weighting. That's the highest that it's been in quite some time. Usually we're running pretty close to fully deployed at the end of 2020. So 6 months ago, we were at 5% for context. So we've more than doubled there. We're a long only fund. So this is really our way to hedge. It's to carry a healthier cash position. And you know, the reasoning is this: we're in a difficult spot here as natural resource focused investors. From my perspective, the general markets, asset classes broadly, are at a pretty serious risk of a sustained correction here at some point in the near future. Jeremy Grantham's on the record of saying that we're in the bubbles of all bubbles. And we know if there's a sustained risk off event, or when there's the next sustained risk off event, similar to what we saw in spring of last year, spurred on by coronavirus, we're going to get hit hard, very hard in the natural resource space, even if the cause of the sell-off's at no fault of our own. And so, when I look out there and I see the return of retail investors and mass to the market, I see the SPAC and cryptocurrency crazes that have been ongoing now for a good year plus. Just looking at the spread of growth to value names. Looking at the fact that valuations are in the top decile of what they've been historically over the past 100 years, like the anecdotal evidence is just, it's laid out clearly that we are in a euphoric stage of the market and the animal spirits are certainly out. And so, that said, from a natural resource perspective, looking back historically, we're still very, very well positioned here for the coming years. Even after the strong period of 15 odd months of performance since the coronavirus sell-off last spring, natural resource equities generally, commodity futures themselves, on a whole host of metrics, we're at historical lows, at or near historical lows, going back 100 years when comparing prices and equity mining equities to the broader stock market, to the S&P 500 in particular. And so that to me gives me gives me strong conviction here over the coming years, coming decade, per se, that we're in the right sandbox. But there's always the risk in the near term of sharp pullbacks, 30-40% pullbacks, as we saw last spring. This cash is kind of following the mindset of it's better to be approximately right than 100% wrong. we're at 12% now. We'll be building up towards 20% over the course of the next 6 months, assuming that the market remains strong or, largely flat. And, this will ensure that our downside is at least somewhat blunted when we do see that next major risk off episode. And just as importantly, it'll ensure that we have dry powder ready to go to deploy next time that there's blood in the street. So I imagine that will be in the 15 to 20% range here, for the foreseeable future. And when it's time to deploy, we'll know. It will be clear. It will be panic days. Portfolio will have probably experienced a healthy drawdown. Names that we're following and like can be down 30-40%. At that point, it's time to deploy some of this capital. And in the meantime, let's say things keep running here, and we have a second half of 2021 that rivals the second half of 2020, where the MJG fund was up over 100%. It is 102% over a 6 month period. Unprecedented performance, at least from our inception. And if that happens, then great. We're still heavily exposed here. So I think it's prudent to be increasing cash, and that's how we're going about it. That's how we're thinking about it.
Yeah, Matt, you've had a great performance in the fund, and it makes a lot of sense to have moved some of the chips off the table into a little bit more secure position with the cash to be able to pounce on those pullbacks when they do come. Maybe share with us some of your thoughts when you had that nice run up in the fund and there was different commodities and different sectors and different positions you had running. What ones did you lighten up on? What commodities or what areas or subsectors? And what ones did you put a little more focus on as you rebalanced the portfolio, keeping in mind some of that went to cash for a rainy day?
Well, I guess going back to summer and fall of last year, that was when precious metals were in the midst of that historic run where we saw an all-time gold price of just below $2,100 an ounce. And so, going back to last August, We got up to 75% precious metals waiting there for a matter of a few weeks, kind of right towards the peak in August. And so at that point, out of prudence, I mean, we're a natural resource focused fund. We're already focusing on a pretty narrow niche of the market. We're not going all in on precious metals at any point in the future, nor would we go all in on battery metals for that matter, or any specific slice of the resource industry. I made the decision at that point not to initiate any new gold or silver focused positions for the foreseeable future. And that actually remains the case today. We've added to names in recent months that are existing holdings within the portfolio, but we haven't initiated any new gold or silver focused names since that time period. So that's helped bring our precious metals exposure back down. I think we're sitting right around 35% at the moment between gold and silver focused names. And that's just due to the correction we've seen, as well as some profit taking and restraint from initiating new positions. Then, for the remainder of 2020 and into early 2021, it was the battery metals time to shine. You saw it across the board, whether it's copper, lithium, rare earths are getting attention again. Uranium has seen a lot of speculative interest in recent months. And so, then at that point, by February, which was kind of the short-term peak that we saw in terms of this flurry of speculative interest, we were closer to 60% energy metal weighted at that point. There has been a pullback in recent months. It got too euphoric. Valuations got ahead of themselves. And we did take some profits in some names lightly. One of them I mentioned in the investor letter, Nova Royalty, which is our largest position within the portfolio, and a name that, assuming management stays disciplined and keeps things lean as they have been, I imagine it's going to be a position here for a number of years. I really like the strategy that they're executing here, and they have the platform to do it at their current market cap, the company's current positioning. But even then, we have a hard limit on position sizing within the portfolio at 20% for a given name. and Nova ran up so much that it was prudent to trim. So I think we're at 80% of our original position there. It was still a core holding. So again, now I feel as if we're pretty well balanced at the moment. We're somewhere between 35-40% energy metal focused at the moment, somewhere around 35% precious metal focused. We have some ag mineral exposure in there as well. And then our decent cash position. So I'm not feeling overexposed at the moment to any particular niche of the resource space.
So Matt, one aspect of the sector that we were chatting about even before recording here is the prospect generator model. So the companies that build up a lot of different properties, sometimes around the world, sometimes focused in certain jurisdictions, do surface work or some of the easier exploration work to generate targets, and then look for partners to spend their money on exploring these targets. This model kind of come out of favor recently. A lot of investors seem to be more focused on the companies that are drilling their own projects and those ones that are having success. But you think that this prospect generator model is going to return back into favor for investors. Why do you think that?
I do. And you're absolutely right. I would be a bit more aggressive there, actually, and say it's been out of favor for over a decade now. It's been a period of a lot of folks giving up on the business model in its entirety. There are various reasons for that. I would just say generally though, we're entering into what is going to be an exploration bull market here in the coming years. It's an exciting time. We've really seen the major producers out there for a couple decades now, really since the early 2000s. Focus on growing their reserves through decreasing their cutoff grades and advancing their later stage assets, and that's worked for a matter of years. But I think the major producers here pushed the limit, and there's limited additional ounces that can be gleaned from both of these. So discovery is going to be necessary here, really across the board, in order to replenish the pipelines of these major producers. And so I feel very strongly that majors that have slashed their exploration teams and slashed their budgets over the past couple decades, we're going to see the reverse of that in these coming few years, rebuilding their teams and doing exploration on their own, as well as partnering with geologically competent prospect generators, whether that's through a strategic alliance, whether that's through joint ventures, whether that's through earning deals with these parties. There's going to be a steady stream of news coming forward. And a recent example would be Riverside with their announcement of BHP with the Copper Strategic Alliance in northern Mexico. And again, this is a niche of the market where you're not seeing a lot of speculative premium built into many of these share prices. A lot of these companies are trading with pretty healthy working cap to market cap ratios, which is a sign of potentially lower risk. A couple of the prospect generators that we've been buying in the portfolio in recent weeks and months, Golden Valley Mines and Lara Exploration, are trading right towards the lower end of their 52-week ranges. This is definitely kind of the value way to play this market and to play exploration in particular. In terms of metrics, I did want to mention for your listeners a couple things that I look at when evaluating these companies specifically. Beyond the rest of the good stuff that we've discussed on previous interviews, the people, are they properly incentivized? Do they have the right skill set? Are they focused on big opportunities, all of that. But three metrics in particular that I find useful for prospect generators. The first is, as I mentioned, looking at the company's working capital position, we can say cash plus marketable securities, relative to their market cap. And this is a good approximation for downside risk. This will give you a sense of, in a worst case scenario. And of course, companies can trade below their cash and marketable security position. That does happen on occasion, but this will give you a good sense of, if shit hits the fan, so to speak, in this industry, how bad it could get. And the aforementioned Golden Valley Mines, I mean, they have a cash and marketable security position well in excess of their current market cap, which is pretty shocking. So you're getting the rest of the company for free there. So that's one thing to look at in terms of downside risk. Second metric is the runway to their next financing. And so, you know, more specifically, that would be the company's total working capital position divided by their monthly all-in burn. And that will give you a sense of how long they can go without raising additional capital. And I should note, some of these prospect generators, either have a healthy enough working capital position, or maybe have inflows from advanced royalty payments, or one or two cash flowing royalties. Some of these companies aren't going to have to raise at all. So that's an important point to keep in mind as well. But when you're looking at this runway to the next financing, that's a good measure of the dilution risk. And as we know in this industry, dilution is perhaps the number one enemy of investors in this space. And that's one of the beauties of the prospect generator business model. It's built and designed to minimize dilution, at least with this expiration focus. And then the third metric to look at is what I'd call synthetic revenues versus the company's enterprise value. And so what synthetic revenues are basically the partner expenditures that are expected over the next 12 months. So they might have, multiple, majors earning in on a couple different assets. You take those projected expenditures and then compare it to the company's EV. And that gives you a sense of value. That gives you a sense of how much bang for your buck are you getting by buying the company at the current share price. And so I think these are interesting metrics to use to evaluate the prospect generator space in mass. There's 30 or 40 of these companies, and if you want to do a proper deep dive, line them up 1 through 40 and look at them on these three metrics, and you'll see a few of the names pop up at the top of each of these measures. And so yeah, that's the approach that we take when looking at this space.
Matt, I like that you have a systematic approach to it and that you're looking at these different metrics across the board. But just from a more high level point of view, when you're looking at positioning and prospect generators and how much of your fund you deploy to that business model, are you more interested in companies that are, and I know it's depending on these metrics, but are you also more interested in companies that have a model where they eventually turn their projects into royalties or into more of the JV side of thing where they have a strategic stake in a lot of different projects? Because the pro side of the prospect generator model is, hey, they're diversified across different projects, similar to a royalty company. But the hit that they take sometimes from people in the marketplace and why some investors avoid them is they're so diversified that if they hit on one of their projects, it doesn't move the needle as much as it was on an individual explorer. So I'm just curious as to what you look for most in the prospect generator. Is it something where they're accumulating royalties over time and building a model that way? Or are you looking for one where the JVs are important enough that it still could move the needle?
Yeah, good question. I think that's a fair point. I mean, that's the trade-off with prospect generators, right? If you're investing in this business model, you're conceding that if there is a discovery at any of these major projects that the company stake, you're only going to be getting 20% of the pie, and that's if you're looking at it on a project level stake. So you should also to your point, pay particular attention to the terms of these actual agreements. Is it a free carry through production? Is it a free carry through feasibility? Is it a free carry through a spending milestone? And then the prospect generator themselves are going to have to stump up capital to advance the project, which is obviously less ideal. So those are all things to look at there. I do see a lot of these companies, due to the success of the royalty business model, which is still, within the mining space, a centuries old industry, royalty business model is still a very new innovation here. And it's certainly taken the precious metals industry by storm over the past couple decades. And I think that will continue, and we'll also see increasing prominence amongst the base metal space as well. So that's a way for some of these sleepy prospect generators that have maybe been neglected for a number of years here to revitalize their chances. From my perspective, in terms of new deal flow, tailor it so that the royalty is at the forefront of what you're looking for, and that's going to help you attract investors in this type of market environment. It also makes you a potential takeout target at some point for one of these many junior royalty companies, which are, you know, getting hungrier and hungrier for earlier stage assets. And you've seen examples, you know, of Transition Metals, for instance, doing a deal with Nova Royalty. Pacific Empire, another prospect generator, did as well. So there's already examples of royalty companies out there willing to come in and transact with these prospect generators and take some of the royalties off their hands in exchange for cash and shares. You know, obviously the pioneer of this type of royalty generation model is EMX, EMX Royalty. It's Dave Cole's company there. Paul Stevens out of San Francisco is the largest individual shareholder. Very, very high quality company. It is a fund or it is a holding within MJG. And, you know, they've made a practice of doing this for a couple decades now. I'd actually argue that the fact that they're out there staking new projects, working them, proving them up a little bit, and then bringing in partners, it's being held against them, you know, by the market currently. EMX, relative to some of the other, you know, royalty names, has a relatively high G&A. But I think a lot of folks are escaping that a lot of that money is going into the ground or, you know, to highly qualified geologists that are out there, you know, coming up with new exploration thesis, staking, you know, forgotten or new districts, and then working those projects to the point where they get them in the hands of bigger parties ready to spend significant sums on them. And so there's also the chance here of you know, further consolidation amongst these kind of hybrid project generation names, but that are, you know, amassing larger and larger royalty portfolios. So be interesting to see if EMX is one of those consolidators. You know, that company in particular is very, very specific in terms of price, very disciplined, you know, to their credit. So maybe they won't ultimately end up being the consolidator. But I think that somebody's going to step up here, and we'll start to see some of the higher quality project generators, if they're not getting traction on their own, start to get taken out.
All right, Matt, let's shift our focus a little bit now to the battery metals sector, because you did have a pretty comprehensive update on battery metals and also a company that you initiated an investment in, Strategic Resources. This ties in more to the vanadium sector. Why battery metals? What do you like about battery metals? What's your overall thesis for that sector?
Right. So, again, I want to emphasize, you know, my focus as an investor is on the, you know, company specific fundamentals. So it is on the people involved. It is, you know, generally on the quality of the asset. It's on the company's financial structure, upcoming catalysts, price to value, all of that good stuff. So I try to avoid getting swept into the, you know, to the latest theme of the month or latest trend. But I will say, I mean, it's pretty clear to anybody following this space that decarbonization and the trend towards decarbonization on a global basis is going to transform the mining industry over the coming decades here. And I think this is an excellent way to position yourself, you know, for that transformation, whether it's the nickel, you know, that's going into lithium ion batteries, or the copper, that's the lifeblood of an electrified economy, taking electricity from point A to point B, or, you know, the rare earths that are going into high strength magnets and our EV engines or wind turbines or what have you. You know, this is also a theme that has the ability to attract generalist capital back into our space. And also say, you know, this is more of a hunch at this point. And, you know, we'll, as the years go on, I think we'll get some more empirical evidence on this fact. But I have the sense that these battery metal focused projects, at least on the development side of things, are actually going to have easier permitting progression than some of the other, you know, especially relative to hydrocarbons, but even maybe relative to gold. I think it's easier to get social buy-in. You know, both on a federal and potentially on a local level, but certainly on a federal level for some of these projects, because they're feeding into this clean energy trend. And so, you know, for all these reasons, it's a healthy percentage of our portfolio. I mean, the bulk of the of our energy metal exposure comes from copper, which is, you know, the easiest way to play the space, you know, at large. Very, very limited substitution risk for copper, particularly at these prices. So as the world continues to electrify, copper is going to be a key beneficiary and an unquestionable piece of the picture going forward.
Well, Matt, there's no doubt that the energy metal space has a lot of different facets, but it's definitely been in vogue, whether it's copper, lithium, uranium, even some interest in the rare earths, as you mentioned. There has been a pretty good run that a lot of the companies went on. And some people are even now throwing platinum and palladium in there with some of the fuel cell technology. So there's a lot of different ways to play it. But as you mentioned, copper in particular was the one that you had weighted the heaviest. And you, I think it'd be nice to back up the clock and look at what you looked at in copper a year ago and how you see it today. And then maybe just a quick thought on what you think of the uranium market. So particularly copper and uranium, what are you looking at with those two sectors and the companies you're positioned in?
Well, in the July 2020 investor letter, backing up there, there was a piece called Copper, Gold, and a False Choice. And again, this the context then was that we were in the midst of the run up to all-time high gold prices, and precious metals were the rage. And copper and really the rest of the energy metal complex was being forgotten. And the point I made there was pretty simple. It wasn't a dramatic call on copper about to spike. It was though a statement looking back at the past 40 years that copper had never been cheaper relative to gold over that period, and that was the case in July and August of last year. And so it seemed clear to me that if you were bullish on gold, you should also be bullish on copper. I'm a big believer in reversion to the mean. That's generally what happens when you look at history. Of course, there are the occasional paradigm shift here or there, but it just didn't. The disparity in valuations between prices between the two metals just did not square with my understanding of copper's essential role in the continued decarbonization of the global economy. And so it was making the point that reversion to the mean is likely, and gold could stay flat and the copper price would have to go up 60-75% in order to hit the 40-year mean. And I did note in the article that this is going to be a long-term process and it'll take years of patience. I was very much wrong on that. In the past 10 months here, we have seen copper come all the way back. When I wrote that article, it was trading around $2.75 per pound. It hit an all-time high of roughly $4.80 per pound in early May here. And gold has stayed largely flat over this period. It's pulled back actually 10% from the all-time high that we saw last August. So now looking at this same metric, you can say that copper is trading fairly relative to gold, at least from a historical standard. And so I think it's hard, to make a definitive call. And I try to stay out of the prediction business at all. It's just the disparities we saw last summer, drew me to the point where I, needed to comment on it and call it out. Just for some context for your listeners, and often you'll see in these mean reversion processes for the pendulum to overshoot. So, there is a possibility that, copper 6 months from now, 12 months from now, gets quite expensive relative to gold in a historical basis. And I was doing some rough numbers. If we saw the same copper to gold ratio that we saw in 2006, 2007, so kind of in the later stages of the 2002, 2007 China-driven commodity boom, you could in theory see copper at $10 a pound without gold moving an inch from this 1800 or 1900 per ounce range. That's not a prediction. I'm not expecting that to happen, but that is in theory within the realm of possibility. Should inflation remain strong and global growth remain strong as well. Which would probably continue the trends that we've seen over the past 9 months or so. And then you asked for a quick comment on uranium. We're down to about 6% uranium exposure within the portfolio. It actually got as high as close to 15% or so in the spring. But our core uranium position, we've taken some healthy profits there. It's still a decently sized holding. In hindsight, given the price action we've seen over the past 4 to 8 weeks, that was a good choice to take some profits. I love uranium as a metal here. It's another of these energy metals that's integral for the world's decarbonization plans going forward, even if a lot of folks don't realize that yet. But the reality is, especially some of the more speculative juniors just got far ahead of themselves. And, you know, uranium still continues to be priced in the low 30s, at least on a spot basis. And, you know, many of these companies were trading at, you know, 1x NPV multiples, you know, at $60 uranium, you know, and not factoring in permitting risk or, you know, long timelines to production. And so things just got ahead of itself. So, you know, we're starting to see a bit of a pullback here. I think if we go into a broader risk off, you know, period in the markets, uranium stocks are, you know, in particular risk of a very sharp pullback just because of the broad speculative interest we've seen. We've seen a ton of non-mining investors and traders and generalists and retail folks come into the space. And so, you know, again, this is a metal that I feel good about over a 3 to 5 year time horizon. But in the immediate term, if the market doesn't cooperate, there's certainly more potential pain ahead. And so, you know, my emphasis in terms of looking at new uranium focused names is to stay away really from the expiration names en masse. You know, from my perspective, there's enough pounds in the ground that have already been discovered, but are not currently under production, where the bar is just so high in terms of new discoveries in order to make a dent in a meaningful timeline on the industry. And, you know, so really focusing on the handful of later stage development assets that have true production potential, you know, this decade. And, you know, even taking a look at, you know, larger producers, Kazatomprom, which is not a fund holding, but, you know, it's a name that I'm keeping close tabs on. And I think there's also, you know, merit, you know, looking at the UPCs of the world or the yellow cakes as well is probably the easiest way to play the actual metals future prospects without taking on, you know, company specific risks. So I would urge caution for investors. I think it's going to be a great place to be over the coming 3, 4, 5 years, but that doesn't mean that a lot of these juniors couldn't be down 40%, you know, come December of this year. So it's a mixed picture for sure.
All right, Matt, we're going to wrap it up here. Sounds like still a little bit of patience is needed for a wide range of the resource sector. But hey, man, your comments always very insightful. I really appreciate you spending time with us on this weekend show and for this extended segment. I hope everybody got a lot out of that interview. And again, remember to click that link in that weekend show posting to read over Matt's investor letter out of MJG Capital. Matt, thanks again for your time, buddy. Have a great rest of your weekend.
You too, Corey. Thanks, Chad.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.